A close call with death. Have you had one? I have. I've had a lot of them, but who's counting? In this session, we'll talk about the events of those of us that have come dangerously close to death and had the great luck or destiny to elude death and carry on. Enjoy the show. So tonight, I have in studio Mark Webb. And I know Mark here in Utah and have come to learn of his challenging condition that he suffered with for the last couple of years. In fact, it's kind of like a birthday of when you first were diagnosed with your condition 2 years as of this month, correct?
That's right.
So great timing on a terrible situation, but we're going to make the best of the conversation today just so that we can talk about what's happened with you in the last couple of years, because you've had an amazing life up to this point, and going through what you have in the last couple of years, it's interesting for my audience to know what it's like for someone to really endure the challenging situation that you've had to endure for the last couple of years, and where you're at now and where you're going forward. So before we jump into your story, Mark, tell us about you and your family dynamics, a little bit about you, some color on you.
Yeah, you bet. So I am married, a father of four. I have two boys, two girls.
Perfect. Did you guys plan that or something?
I don't know.
Perfect 50-50.
It worked out 50-50. Went boy, girl, boy, girl. So it was what we were, you know, we couldn't have planned it any better.
Yes, seriously. It's great.
It worked out. So my children are grown for the most part. I have three of them are married. First grandchild was born last November.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's great.
Baby girl. My youngest is serving a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Denver.
Denver, Colorado.
Spanish speaking.
Well, that's fantastic.
So she's there. She has 6 months left serving that mission, and she'll be back and move on to
join the family and
college,
do other things,
hang out with us for a little while, and
yeah,
then move on. Yeah,
awesome. So where do you live?
I live in Cedar Hills, Utah.
Where is that?
That is in North Utah County. It's right near Highland Alpine American Fork area,
which is geographically between Salt Lake City and Provo, Utah.
That is right.
In there for people that have never been to Utah, it'll kind of give them a little bit of an idea where in Utah that is.
Yep. It's between the two and it's right next to the mountains.
So it's just beautiful over there.
Yeah.
Great community.
Yeah. Great place. Great place for our kids to grow up. And so been, you know, enjoyable life for sure.
So how old are you now?
I am 56.
You struggle with that? Like, I don't want to say, but that's okay. We're not holding anything against you or anything. You're at the prime of your life and good things going. Did you grow up around here in Utah all your life or?
No, but I did for a while. I went to elementary school and junior high at American Fork. But then we moved away and I went to high school in Texas.
Where in Texas?
In Plano, Texas, north of Dallas.
Yep.
Graduated from there, and immediately the summer that I graduated, my family moved to Southern California.
Where in Southern Cal?
Southern California in Torrance first, and then later to Oceanside.
Fantastic.
Further, you know, San Diego County. Mm-hmm. I was there just off and on, because at that point I, you know, attended college and I also did serve as a missionary for my church.
So you did what your daughter's doing now.
That's right. Yep.
And when you were serving in California?
I served in South America in the country of Chile.
So you speak Spanish.
In the city of Santiago, yes.
Fantastic. So your daughter's going to be able to speak Spanish with you when she gets back, and that's going to be fun.
That's right, yeah.
That's so cool. Nice. So when you got done with your mission, then you went to college and finished up there?
Yes. I went to Brigham Young University. So I went to BYU.
In Provo.
In Provo. Studied accounting. Graduated with a degree, a bachelor's and a master's degree. Started my career in public accounting with PricewaterhouseCoopers. Mm-hmm. Worked there for a few years and then left. And I've spent most of my career in technology companies of one form or another, largely software companies, but also hardware, you know, consumer electronics, mm-hmm. And other things. And kind of during
like what Utah's really known for. I mean, Southern Cal and Silicon Valley has been so techy, but Utah and our little Silicon Slope area has become real tech center. So you're right at home here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's been a great place to be with all the, you know, all the companies that have formed from the early ones, which formed the basis of the tech development, like companies like Novell and WordPerfect and
big names.
Some of the Evans and Sutherland, the graphics companies and others. Mm-hmm. And then from those early beginnings, many sprouted, right? Even Megahertz was one of the early companies. And so it's been a great place to be in my world as an accounting person, to be a chief financial officer in software, SaaS world has been great. And during that journey is kind of where you and I met along the way as a service provider to companies.
So
formed those relationships, good working relationships with lots of people. And
absolutely,
it's been an enjoyable career. And
you enjoy outdoors, you enjoy golf, and actually I've played golf with you. And when I found out that you had this condition that came upon you a couple of years ago, it was devastating. And, you know, I was worried about you. And so we're going to meet getting into that in a minute or so. But I'm just so glad that you're here with me tonight to talk about your story and that you look good. I mean, you look like your life is coming back into you.
Yeah, for sure. Because as we talk about it, it's... It was a battle. Yeah, I've been to some very different places during that journey. That's for sure.
You know, Mark, your career has been great. It's provided a wonderful living for you to live in a gorgeous place in Utah. You have a great family. You've got four kids. Now you're having grandchildren. Happy marriage. I mean, everything is just rolling along. Just wonderful. And then you get the news of something so harsh. When did that talk to me about what's happened to you, when you found out, how you found out, and a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Things were going, you know, swimmingly well. In fact, I also ride motorcycles, right? I have a Harley. My wife has a Harley.
So you both ride. She's not just riding on the back. You both ride. That's cool.
That's right. Yeah. She used to ride on the back. Then she decided along the way. I want my own. So she got her own. She'll still ride on the back with me sometimes. But and then I thought, well, I want a bike where I can go off-road too. So I bought an adventure-style bike. Mm-hmm. So I just bought that. And then what happened in June 2 years ago, and maybe a little bit leading up to that, what I noticed going on in my body was not a big deal, but I noticed I was having a little trouble swallowing food sometimes. I'd have to pause and wait for food to go down.
Mm-hmm. Like your neck was just swollen? Like your throat was swollen?
Or I've swallowed too fast or something. Yeah. I have to wait and food would go down and then I'd keep eating. But I asked my doctor, just my, you know, general doctor about it. And he said, well, that can happen. It's usually from acid reflux. A lot of people get an acid reflux condition. It can cause that. But to know for sure, you'd have to get an endoscopy. So he said, here, if you want, we can try some medication to treat acid reflux and see what happens. So we did that. And it was kind of, maybe it got a little better. I wasn't 100% sure, but it didn't go away. And so a few months after that, I thought, well, I called him up and said, maybe it's time. Maybe we should go get it checked. And so I scheduled an endoscopy. And I went in to get that endoscopy done.
What is an endoscopy?
Endoscopy is where the doctors just take a camera and they put it down, in your mouth, down your throat. They go in and look at your esophagus, your stomach.
Everything, your and about, GI tract.
Yeah, but about to your stomach. This particular one didn't go past my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor went in and checked it out. Which is a pretty easy procedure, and they use a medication called propofol to put you to sleep.
So I was just going to ask you were not awake when they did this, right?
No.
That'd be so scary.
Yeah.
Oh.
But I will have to say, I'm a big fan of propofol naps. They're very nice.
Super nice. Yeah. I wish I could get one every afternoon. That'd be awesome.
That's right.
But nothing more calming and peaceful than when they give you that, right?
Yeah, it just knocks you out. And I don't wake up quickly from it either. But anyway, so I wake up, a doctor comes in and tells me how it went.
Yeah.
And he said, camera going down, everything was looking really good. Esophagus, GI junction, stomach, everything looks great. We turn the camera around as we come back up so we can look the other direction. He said, when I got up near the top of your stomach, I saw a growth. Like there's a little tumor there at the top of your stomach. So I biopsied, took a bunch of biopsies. It's small, so I think we've found it kind of early. But he actually said, I'm kind of scared. And I was like, oh, great.
Did that scare you at that moment?
It scared my wife, who was there.
Yeah.
It didn't give me, I didn't have fear. Like, I wasn't afraid right then. I was like, okay, it's probably not great news, but we'll see what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of prepared for bad news, but I had to wait for the results to come back of the test to see what it was.
How long did that take?
It was a few days, maybe four. I think it might have been over a weekend. That might have happened on a Friday, and I had to wait, and I got a call the next Tuesday.
Did you even sleep at night? Like, is that something that keeps you up at night? Did you really worry and stress about that while you're waiting for day after day for the results to come back?
I didn't. At the time, I felt pretty calm. It didn't bother me too much.
Good.
I felt pretty calm. But I got a call in my office. I was at work on Tuesday.
Okay, so this wasn't a call from the doctor late at night where you know something's really horrible. It just called you during the day.
Yeah. Results came in, and he said, it's cancerous. So that was the day. I had the day where you get the C word. I was like,
How did you feel when you heard that word?
I was like, oh.
Through your mind.
Yeah. It was kind of like the thought of, boy, I know this happens every day to people.
Yeah, yeah.
You just hope it is never your day.
Right.
And it was my day. And so I thought, okay, wow, now what? Like, what do you do now?
Mm-hmm.
I always felt like, okay, stuff happens. I don't know why exactly, but I'll deal with it. Like, we'll figure it out. So I felt okay. And I did learn that, boy, once you get diagnosed with cancer, at least in Utah, the machinery begins quickly.
Really?
Like, the medical machinery starts. And the doctor said, we've got you, I don't know if he already had it scheduled or he said, we're going to get you scheduled for another endoscopy that uses ultrasound to classify the cancer, what stage it's at, because they can see how far into the tissue the tumor has grown, you know, into the stomach lining, so they can stage the cancer. And like that was within a couple of days.
Hey, and you know what? You've as you go through an illness like this, you become kind of like a resident expert on the condition and all right. that. Talk to me and the listeners about the definition of like stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. Because oftentimes you hear on TV, oh my gosh, it's stage 4 cancer. What does that mean? What are the different stages?
Yeah, well, And I don't remember the exact definitions, but they're classifications as to how far the cancer has spread or has grown into surrounding tissue.
Okay.
And so stage 4 means the cancer is not isolated to a tumor any longer, but it's actually spread into tissues nearby or into lymph nodes or other places.
Or even a bloodstream or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, I went through that, had that done. They classified it as stage 3.
Gosh, and it was such a tiny little tumor.
It was small.
You think, what in the heck? How'd that thing get so carried away so fast?
Yeah. What I did learn. So then I had to find, then it's, well, who's the doctor you go to for treatment, right? Who's the oncologist, as cancer doctors are called, oncologists, right? Who's my oncologist? It's not like you have one of those, right?
Right.
So you need one. There's a story behind that. But anyway, I picked an oncologist, went and visited with the oncologist, looked at the results. He said, yes, the tumor actually has a lot of stage 2 characteristics and some stage 3, but we always classify it to the highest stage. So that's why I said it's stage 3, but some of it
still rounds up.
Rounds up, yeah. So, I mean, that made me feel a little bit better, like, okay, we've got it on the early side of things. And then it was about, well, what are your treatment options? Before that, though, right, you get that news. You're like, oh, wow, what, so I Googled it, right? And you're like, what?
Of course.
Stomach cancer. What kind of cancer do I have and what happens? And the survival rates for stomach cancer are not good.
What are they?
5-year survival rates around 33%.
Even just a 5 years is all, and it's 33. Low for such a short time period.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet when you read that, your heart just sank.
Yeah, I was like, oh, wow, this is not great. Like, this is not one of the more treatable cancers. But I still, I still felt hopeful. There was some good news. Like, of all the crazy thing is, of all the risk factors for stomach cancer, I have none of them. I didn't have any of the risk factors, but now I have stomach cancer. And the oncologist said,
what do you mean by that? What do you mean by risk factors?
Right. People who usually contract stomach cancer have
things that contribute towards that.
If they have certain risk factors, which are things like if you smoke, if you're overweight, if you have drink alcohol, and then there's some other sort of diseases that contribute, and so you're at a higher risk of getting stomach cancer.
You had none of those.
I had none of those, and the oncologist said, as far as we know, stomach cancers aren't really genetic, so it's not like there was a family thing, and not that I knew about that anyway.
Yeah,
another story because I was adopted as a baby, and I don't know any family medical history.
Have you ever taken the DNA testing?
Anything? Yes.
Recently or before this?
Before this. So that's a fun story too. But when this happened, I just put all that. I didn't think about any of that or possible DNA connections and things that I had found.
Yeah.
So all that went on hold. So anyway, to speed, this is a long, you know, it's a long journey, but we'll try to speed it up. So meet with the oncologist, we go over that, the risk factors, the survival rate is not, you know, not great, doesn't look promising. We talk about that. And anyway, he told me, based on where this tumor is, because it's close to your esophagus, right? It's near the junction of your stomach and your esophagus. We can treat it as esophageal cancer, or we can treat it as stomach cancer. And it's been treated as both. And he recommended, he said, maybe the, you know, it's hard to say, but I think the esophageal cancer treatment might be the best. So that consisted of chemotherapy and radiation.
What comes first?
If those are successful, then surgery to remove part of your esophagus, part of your stomach. So how you respond to those. So what came first in my case? So here's a funny story. So this was in June. We usually have a family.
Of the first year.
Yeah, the first year. All this is happening. We usually do a family vacation to a place in southern Utah. There's a lake called Lake Powell, which is it's an amazing place. We go
it's
there,
magical.
We go there every year.
We're going to go there this weekend.
Yeah, great.
It's beautiful. Nice. Listeners have not checked out Lake Powell, Google it, look at it on Google Earth, and go there sometime and check it out. It is one of the most fascinating, beautiful places on the planet.
Yes, it is. It's a great place. My family loves it. But I tell the doctor, I'm like, okay, we want to start treatment right away, but we have this trip. And he says, well, you should go on that trip. I'm like, are you saying that because I might not have many more?
Yeah. You're starting to read things into everything. Yeah.
He's like, no, but here, we'll give you a couple doses of chemo prior. You can go on the trip, come back, and then we'll start you up. So I started chemotherapy first and then started the radiation treatment and chemotherapy in conjunction after we came home from that trip. So basically the end of July, I began both treatments in earnest. And radiation is every weekday for 28 days.
Oh. How long does it take each treatment?
It's short. It was, 10 or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But you lay on a table. They work out how they're going to radiate the area they need to hit. In fact, with a physicist, because they try to get the angles right, so they shoot you to try to hit the tumor without hitting your heart or your lungs or other parts of your body. So they have to work out all these angles at which they can shoot the radiation at your body and zero in on that one space. So they get that all figured out. You go lay down, this machine moves around you and shoots you with radiation, but you're done pretty quickly. And fortunately I didn't have a bad reaction to the radiation treatment itself, which can make you sick. Chemo can makes you sick too, mm-hmm. But the radiation didn't make me too sick. I was also on, they give you anti-nausea medication. They give you a bunch of things to try to counteract what's possibly coming. And it seemed to help. So I went through that. Towards the end of that treatment, it started to get rough.
How?
The radiation oncologist told me, he said, listen, we're hitting that spot with radiation. And as you get towards the end, that inside of you, your esophagus, is going to look like, if we went in and looked at it, it would look like a terrible sunburn, like blistered, burned tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to hurt. And it did. And so they put me on pain medication. So I was on fentanyl. A fentanyl patch.
Oh my gosh.
The biggest patch they give you. And oxycodone liquid. I was on both of those to be able to eat, to get anything down.
Did it kill the pain?
And it helped significantly. But I did get, it got to a point And it even gets worse after you finish. He said, here, we'll, you know, you'll be done with your treatment, which is great, but it's not going to get, it's going to get worse before it gets better. Hmm. It's going to feel worse before it gets better. And he was right. But yeah, it was almost, even on, you know, as high a dose as they would let me take. So I had the fentanyl patch going, and as much oxycodone as they would let me take, as fast as they would let me take it, I had to take to be able to eat, and then I could barely eat. So I was losing weight, right, during this period of time. I lost 20 pounds. I'm not a big guy anyway, but I lost 20 pounds.
Yeah, like your normal weight is how much?
Yeah, I was like 155.
155. You are lean.
Yeah.
And you're talking about losing 20 pounds off of that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm down to 135, maybe 134 or 3, somewhere in there. And anyway, I get through that, and I start to recover and feel better. And they say, hey, this things look good, so let's get your surgery lined up. It looks like you've responded well. The tumor, I had tests and scans, and the tumor had, had decreased in size. It wasn't big, but it had gone down. They thought I responded pretty well. So they're scheduling me for surgery. But you never know, right? Like, I would go in for chemotherapy treatment and sit in a chemo chair next to other patients who were getting treated for other, they're getting chemo for other types of cancer.
By the way, why do they do that? Do they ever explain to you why they want to put you in a room with other people getting that, just so that, is it some kind of psychological support or group support, or they're out of rooms? What in the world? Why are you having to sit there when you could probably be in a private room watching a movie or something? Why do they do that?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Did you ever ask him, can I go someplace else?
Interesting question.
Was it uncomfortable with the other people there with you, or do
no.
you have, strike up some great conversations yeah. with people suffering too?
I mean, there might be something to it.
Yeah. We need to find out what that is.
But there is, yeah, you do kind of become part of this group of people who are suffering through, you know, this fight with cancer. And yeah. Yes, I met several people, and I talked to them along the way, and oh, okay, what do you have? And how are you, you know, how's it going? And so, there is some benefit, right? There is some benefit.
What happens if all of a sudden one of the people in the chair don't show up anymore? Yeah. They're either done or they're gone. That's kind of scary.
Yeah, it is. In fact, I met one guy and talked to him, and my wife would be there sometimes with me, and mm-hmm. and so she met him as well, and we got to know this guy who also had stomach cancer. Well, actually, his was colon cancer, not stomach cancer, but caught late. So, and he wasn't going to make it, and he knew he wasn't going to make it, but he was being treated to buy him enough time as he could buy, and he was about my age. He could have been a few years. He was actually a few years younger than me. Mm. But he'd gone through treatment and had responded and bought himself some time. And so he, and one day we met his wife. His wife was in the chemo room there mm-hmm. too. So we got to talk to her, and they were going on trips and doing these family vacations and just trying to fit in everything they could before it came back on him. And he was in that place. He knew his clock was ticking, and it wasn't curable. And so I still had hope.
Yes.
Of a cure at that point. And the oncologist said, that's what we're going for. There's a chance for a cure. We're going for a cure. We're going to treat you aggressively. And you know, we'll see what happens. So anyway, I did that treatment. Oh, I wanted to mention one thing, right? You never, like, you meet a lot of people and you see a lot of people going through this, but you never know kind of what everyone's experience is like. How hard, right? Are they all as hard? Is everything as hard as yeah. mine? Is mine easy compared to yours? You don't know. But one day I was talking to a nurse, one of the chemo nurses, and she said, you know, of all the cancers we treat, the one you have is the one we don't want. because the treatment is so awful. Hmm. And so I was like, wow. And that was the only, that was one of the things I got a perspective on, like, how is this? Like, how is this compared to other things? I got the perspective, at least from her, that
there's the worst,
that this is a rough one. Like, it, because of the esophagus, and that's such an important, I mean, that's how you eat. That's how so many things have to pass through there. And it's now it's so damaged that the pain, like I would try to, when I was eating during this time period of dealing with that, I'd fall to the floor just trembling in pain, trying to swallow something, even with all the painkillers.
Oh my gosh.
It was so bad.
Well, you know, is liquid, like fluids, liquid food, an option where it's just a line goes into your stomach rather versus you having to put it down your throat?
Or no? I think it can be sometimes, but they try not to go there immediately.
Yeah.
If you can make it, because that's another surgery and more trauma to your body and, mm-hmm. you know, other things.
It's just so sad that in a world as technical as we have, they have to suffer at that level, you know, to just swallow, and that every time is just absolutely excruciating. It's just sad that we have to put up with that kind of pain with the kind of medication that we have and mm-hmm. medical technology.
Yeah. Makes me wonder why, why our bodies are that way. Like why the physical pain?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we'll get into that. So anyway, I need to gain some weight to be able to go have surgery. They want me to gain some weight, gain strength back, recover from this treatment as best I can. So that's in, I finished that up in September, and I get surgery scheduled for the middle of November. So I'm recovering, trying to walk and build up strength. I'm not working anymore, you know. Fortunately, I had disability insurance and other things that kind of at least help pay the bills. And
so at this point, you terminated your employment versus like taking some time off or vacation time or whatever. This is going to be a long enough process to where it was time to go out on disability or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've burned up all of those. I've burned through all of that, and now I've had to transition onto, you know, disability plans. And fortunately my employer had those, and that was, you know, very grateful for that. So gaining some strength, I make it, you know, I do well enough that, okay, well, you can go in and you can handle surgery. And this is a pretty major surgery, right? They're going to open me up. They're going to, you know, big incision from my rib cage to my belly button, and possibly go in through my ribs into my, inside my rib cage. They may have to go in if they can't do the whole surgery from the abdomen. So I have a thoracic surgeon and an abdominal surgeon both ready, to do this. So we go in, and what they're going to do is remove part of my esophagus, part of my stomach, turn my stomach, you know, into a makeshift esophagus, and hook it back together. So that's their, that's the plan. So I go in for surgery, and it's a you know, pretty long surgery, and it's a 10-day in the hospital recovery. So they keep you there. They have to make sure, they have to check for leaks, you know, they make sure you can, that all that works out. So anyway, I go through that. I come out of surgery, and I'm laying in the bed, and I'm kind of coming to. And a nurse says to me, "Hey, let me get you something to drink." And I think, I can't drink anything. Like, I can't even eat.
Right? Yeah,
They put a feeding tube, like, that was part of it, put a feeding tube in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then my wife is there and she's, and she realizes, oh, Mark doesn't know what happened. I don't. And so she tells me, she has to tell me, she's like, oh no, like I have to tell him what happened. So they opened me up and looked at my, got my stomach kind of out, and the surgeon looked at it and found more cancer on the outside of my stomach.
Oh no.
And he said, oh no, and worse things.
Oh no.
But it was small enough. It wasn't detected, right? They couldn't, they did, none of the scans or anything could detect those little growths on the outside of my stomach. So it wasn't, nobody knew. And he didn't know until he saw it. And he's like, oh man, now what? So he told me they did a little conference call powwow and tried to figure out, okay, well, what do? Do we take it out? Do we leave it in? They decided to put it back in, sew me back up, send me out, send me back for more chemo treatment.
Oh, jeez.
So that's what happened. I find out that's what happened. Okay, so, you know, certainly didn't go according to plan. Not according to hope. Not according to a lot of things. So now what feels like another, a big setback and worse. So anyway, I go through that, go, and my oncologist now says, let's, we'll start you up on chemo as soon as we can. And this is, it's tougher, right? We're going to give you stronger stuff. Mm-hmm. But within, it was within a couple of weeks after that surgery. I mean, I needed some time to recover, but they gave me very little. And then I started on chemo. And I know lots of people go through chemo and these things, so it's not unique to me, but it's, you know, you get your dose of chemo and you can, for a few days, you kind of feel okay. And then it kind of takes you down. And, you know, then after, you know, after 7 or 8 days, I'll recover and start to bounce back a little bit. And then I'd go again. So this was every two, so it was every 14 days I was going in for a chemo treatment. And the chemo impact is cumulative in your body. So I started to get to a point where I wouldn't bounce back anymore. I wouldn't feel better at all. And the first round I kind of handled okay. The second round, I mean, I went bald, shiny bald, lost all my hair, lots of other side effects, sickness, neuropathy in my legs and feet, which are still, no, I still have that.
To where you really can't feel things with your feet.
Is right, that? Right. My feet are numb. Feel like I walk on wooden blocks.
That's so crazy. Does it make it hard to walk?
I can walk okay. I can run not that great. Okay. The thing, I can do most things okay. The one place that I have to be cautious is when I go up or down stairs, I have to look more closely because I can't feel as well.
Yeah.
Like if I'm on the edge of the step or on the full step or mm-hmm. things that you can detect, I can't feel that as well. So I have to be a little more careful there. Skiing is a little weird, but I got that figured out. I was able to ski again. Yeah. But yeah, things you don't get the sensation in your feet. And lots of side effects, you know, that I hope to forget. anyway, I go through that. I finish that. And so then I get a bunch of tests. I have to recover from that part of it to potentially have surgery, right? The doctors still say, listen, the best, if the cancer has not spread to other parts of your abdomen, which is, they're concerned that's highly likely, right? That, especially with things on the outside of my stomach that are touching other parts of my abdomen, that it could easily spread. So they also recommend I do another form of chemo treatment called HIPEC chemo, which is a treatment where they don't put the chemotherapy medication in your bloodstream. They actually wash it around your abdomen. Like they for an hour and a half, they basically rinse it around your abdomen. It's a heated chemo.
How in the world do they do that?
Yeah, they do it. It's a laparoscopic procedure, but they put, they punch two holes in your upper abdomen and two in your lower abdomen and one for a camera. And then they feed it in through two tubes, and then they suck it out through the other two tubes, and they kind of just flush it through you for an hour and a half.
Oh my gosh. Is that painful?
No. Fortunately, I'm out.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
I'm out. And because it's laparoscopic, the recovery's wasn't too bad. But they do that, and then they do some tests as part of that. They're referred to as washing tests. And I had one at the first surgery and others where they actually take liquid from your abdomen and they examine the liquid to make sure you don't have any free-floating cancer cells. Mm. So I had that done twice, and it was negative. They didn't find any free-floating cancer cells in my abdomen, which was a good sign that maybe, you know, it hadn't spread, it hadn't gotten out yet. And then I have other scans and tests after these chemo treatments to look for signs of cancer anywhere else. They determine there's no sign of cancer anywhere else. We think removing your stomach is your best shot. You don't have to get it taken out, but if you keep it in, you're at a very high risk of this cancer returning. Hmm. So we have to make that decision. Do I get my stomach taken out? Which is a big surgery and a life-changing surgery with how you eat and all of that after that happens. So we decide to do that. That's the end of July.
Go ahead and take this stomach out.
Go ahead and take my stomach out. So I plan for that, and that's coming up on a year ago, right? That's in July of a year ago. So anyway, I go through that surgery, and that's a tough deal too for anyone who goes through that. The first 3 months of recovery were really difficult. Eating hurts. You have to eat liquid diet for a while, then soft food, and then you can start eating other foods. And you know, the surgeon says, "Listen, it's going to take a while, but you will adapt." Miraculously, right, your small intestine can adapt to no stomach. Your small intestine is used to getting food that's pre-processed by your stomach, right? It's liquefied stomach acid, and then it just drips into your small intestine slowly. But now your small intestine is getting it
full bore. You know,
full bore. It's raw and a lot. But it adapts over time, but it takes a while. And they said, he told me it's probably up to 2 years. For a period of 2 years, your body will continue to handle things better. So anyway, that's what I came through that. First 3 months were awful. Hit about month four, and I started to, eating became a little bit more bearable. Even during that time, I had to use a feeding tube oftentimes to get enough calories into me because I lost even more weight. So... Not only did
you were
20
stick.
Pounds the first time, now I lost another 10. So I was down around 30 pounds. So yeah, I was a 122 pound.
How tall are you?
Feather. I'm 6 feet tall.
Yeah, six feet tall, and you weighed down. You were a feather.
So I'm a stick figure. Yeah. and weak, right? And not very strong on top of that. But anyway, so I've come through that. And I'm on the mend, and now I'm in the process of monitoring. So I have scans every 3 or 4 months to look for signs of spreading of the cancer. So far, the scans have been negative. There's no sign of cancer anywhere else in my body right
Fantastic.
Now.
Fantastic.
So that is the good, is the good news.
Yeah.
So, and one thing I'll mention that I didn't, right? When the other cancer on the outside of my stomach was discovered, and I went back, met with my oncologist, the survival rate was a lot worse, right? It wasn't 33% anymore. He said it might be 10, and that would be generous, right? So 10%, so less than 10% chance
of
that
survival.
I'll live very long.
Yeah.
You know, after that. And they do a 5-year survival rate, but most, if cancer's returning within 1 to 2 years, that's typically the time frame in which it's returned. So it still could, right? We're watching that closely, but so far, in my mind, I've beat it. I'm gaining strength back. I'm gaining weight back. I can do stuff. Like this winter, I was able to ski. Not for very long each day, but I could do it.
Yeah.
I can play golf again. I can ride a motorcycle. I am working. Life is fairly normal. You know,
that's fantastic. Yeah. And you know, how important is that, you know, that life get back to normal as much as possible? Does that just help your psyche, and does a good psyche help your recovery?
Yes. There are lots of things that help, but getting enjoyable parts of life back is a good experience, right? It's when you come out of, you know, any experience, but something like where you, chemotherapy, right, it's poison.
Yeah.
They put it in you to kill off cells in your body, and they hopefully kill the bad ones faster than the good ones,
mm-hmm.
right? So it beats you down, you know, pretty hard. But as you recover and you can start to see some progress and get some things back in your life that are enjoyable, yeah, it's encouraging.
Oh,
right? And it helps.
So when they talk about a cancer survivor, and I work with one, Gina Hutchings, her husband was on the show, Brett, he's a helicopter pilot, and Gina went through cancer treatments and she survived. And when we talk about a cancer survivor, I mean, that is a huge battle won. And so many people kind of, oh, yeah, you had cancer and now you're okay. That's great. But that's a huge accomplishment. That is such a blessing, you know, that you can get to the point where you've beat it. I can't imagine when I have the flu or something like that, or I had COVID for a little bit. I didn't know how I was going to make it through that week or two. A week or two, you know, that is nothing compared to what you went through, Mark, with this cancer. And how does a person get through the weeks, through the months, when you know this may take years? How do you work through that in your mind? And who's your support team?
Yeah, it's I did, at least. I don't know if it's the same for everybody, but you get to a mode, my brother-in-law calls it robot mode sometimes, mm-hmm. where you just kind of have to go through the motions of life. Like, you just have to hang in there. And as cliche as it sounds, but it's kind of just a step at a time. Because some days you're not sure if you're gonna make it through the day or how you'll make it through the day. You just have to take it an hour at a time, a breath at a time, a nap at a time, and, you know, how to do that.
So it sounds to me almost like it's one of those things where, and I learned this by talking to Special Forces guys, you don't look all the way down range so far. You look at each moment at a time. You get through that moment. It's almost like Special Forces or military guys who and women that go through you know, the training that they think they'll never make it through. It's so hard, but they do. If you only take a little tiny bit at a time, it gets you it until you're through that first day. And then you're through the second day. And pretty soon it's a week and then it's a month. And they'll get through the training where if you look even beyond a day, you ring out and just like quit because it's just too hard on your mind to think about having to go the distance.
Yeah.
It's a real marathon.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can feel overwhelming easily,
mm-hmm.
if you look too far and feel like you're biting off too much, it can overwhelm your senses for sure.
Who do you turn to when you get to that step?
Yeah. Well, one thing I learned through this process is that other people matter. Like, People can show up, and they do, when people show up for you. Mm-hmm. Family, for sure. But, you know, neighbors, friends. I can't even name the or count, you know, the number of meals or little gifts or things that people, you know, showed up with or came and when my wife needed to go somewhere, came and sat, you know, sat with me when all I could do was sit.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, sometimes we don't know if what we do matters, if we do little things, but speaking as a recipient,
yeah,
you know, they do, right? They matter, and that helps get you through, you know. And then there's a, for me, you know, at least there's a very poignant spiritual journey that was part of this whole process too.
Let's talk about that.
Because it sure, you know, I mean, we all encounter experiences in our lives of many forms that make us, that cause us to ask questions that we may have asked before, but makes us ask them sometimes in a deeper way or in a different way, or even questions that we never thought of before or never had to ask ourselves about why things happen the way they do in this thing we call life, right? This existence that we have. Mm-hmm. And basic questions like why, you know, why is cancer even a thing?
Yeah.
Why is the pain we feel, physical and mental, when you suffer through something like this experience? Why is it so deep, sometimes devastating? Why in the world would we have that level of suffering? Right. And I asked myself lots of questions like how did we get to this existence? Like, how did we get here? And I thought, just to sort of lay the groundwork, I do believe in God, and I have for a long time. But I ask myself questions about if that weren't the case, if there isn't a God, and we just got here through evolution, an evolutionary process, why would evolution get us to a point where this suffering exists? Mm-hmm. It seems like a failure of evolution, right? If evolution is us responding to stimulus and adapting to it, wouldn't we have evolved that kind of suffering out? Like, I don't see the purpose of it.
Right.
So anyway, I went there right in my mind, like, how, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time trying to make sense of what was going on and why that level of physical suffering. And if we want to keep going a bit, I spent a lot of time, you know, reading both, you know, scriptural things, books other people had written, philosophers, listening to some podcasts, some of yours, other folks that have experienced things. Mm-hmm. Near-death experiences, listen to lots of those on YouTube, what people, you know, trying to gain some understanding. So on this journey, right, I went through that journey as well, asking these questions of why and what for. And I, you know, I had to, I had to go back in my mind and in what some of the, you know, some of the things that religions teach, and my religion in particular, about the purpose of life. And in trying to come up with some sort of framework that explains why this makes any sense, why does what I'm going through make any sense? Mm-hmm. Because I definitely experienced points in time where I prayed for many things, right? And I believed that absolutely the power existed to heal this cancer, like to make it go away. Mm-hmm. So if I believe that's possible, can it happen for me? Right. Why not? Can
right.
it?
Yeah.
Should it? Why not? Didn't, right? Didn't happen the way I thought it could happen. Why didn't it happen that way? So anyway, I had to go back into, you know, the sort of the doctrine of, well, what's the purpose of this life? Why did we come here? And did we come here? And did we choose to come here? And where did we come from? You know, all of those questions.
Yeah.
But finally, the only thing that could make sense of this whole, you know, whole situation to me was that there are reasons for this existence that are transcendental, that are bigger than just being here and living your life. Like, there's purpose. And that we actually had some knowledge before we came to this earth as to what we might be getting into. And, you know, if you believe the scriptures, right, which I do, the Bible particularly, that talks about this and others, that there were many people like us who didn't sign up for it, right? Who decided, no, that route is not for me. There's got to be some other way. And I have to believe that we knew and were taught some of the possibilities, like how bad it might be, right? And things like disease and addiction and, you know, war and, you know, mistreatment of all kinds, of torture and slavery and sexual exploitation. And all of these things were possibilities that we might have been warned about. Like, it could get really bad. And you could live in a time where your life expectancy might be 30 years. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's a spectrum. Like, you could live any place on the planet, at any time in the planet's history, and it could be pretty bad. You sign here, you know, like, are you ready? But we also had to, the other part of that is we had the understanding that the reason why that was necessary, right? And one of the reasons why that was necessary, and I've come to, you know, quite believe this, that we were spiritual beings. Now we're on earth, we're a spiritual being and a physical being, a physical body. And there is something about that combination that is necessary in our progression. Like, that in order to go from where we were to where we can possibly go, we had to combine spiritual and physical. So you've got to have that if you want to take the next step. So it's mortality. You got to go through it. If you're going to get to the next phase, you've got to deal with it.
And are you opting in? Is it your choice?
And is
it
your choice?
Are you going to do this?
That's right.
Yeah.
And are you going to do that? And it's going to be awful, and you're going to screw up, and your life could have lots of problems.
But if it can make you better, do you want that?
If it can make you better. And it can make you better. And part of the plan to make it better for you involves the Son of God. It involves who we call Jesus Christ, right? And that part of this whole plan, and what can be just tremendously awful for you, possibly, could also be very joyful, but there's going to be bad and there's going to be good. But part of that plan involves this savior figure. It involves Jesus Christ, who can go, who's going to go and suffer in a way and do things that you can't do. And he can make all of that bad stuff kind of go away for you in the end. You're going to live through it. But it's all going to, he's going to turn it all into goodness for you at some point. Like all the suffering you could potentially deal with. Yeah, it'll be bad. But he can save you. He can redeem you. He can fix all of that. He can heal all of that at some point. But he can't take it away from you. You actually have to pass through it. You've got to go on this journey. You have to choose it, which you did. That's why you're here. And that's the deal, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the deal.
It's a powerful deal.
But Jesus Christ, will show you, give you an example of ways you can deal with it, right? Because
yeah.
He can fix, right? He can resurrect you. Like you can come back from the dead. Like your body can be healed and perfected, right? Whatever happens to you during life, you die, he can heal you, you'll be resurrected, you can be perfect. He can only do that, though, if he goes through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. He can't go around it either, right? And so by learning from his example, like, he had to take it head on. He had to suffer in ways that we can't quite comprehend because of, right?
Right.
How, yeah. At what level does he have to suffer to take away all of the suffering and pain for all of us? There's some miraculous element of the atonement of Jesus Christ that we don't quite, can't put our finger on. But there was no way for him to cheat it. He couldn't skirt it. He had to go through it. Mm-hmm. And if he's the example, and I'm not trying to, you know, say that I am or anyone that goes through trouble is Jesus Christ. But if we look at his example, we have to realize that, okay, maybe I can't cheat this either. I've got to go through it. That for some reason, I've got to make my way through this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And largely, I think it's what it teaches us.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you think about the experience of these climbers that go up Everest and Mount Everest. There's people that freeze to death on the way up or on the way down or being on the mountain. They never even made. They die up there, but they were doing something they loved. They put it all on the line and they tried so hard. And at times you fall and you've got that rope and gear that will help protect you from the total fall. And there's some that will make it all the way up, summit, put the flag in, come back down. They climbed Everest. There's no escalator that goes to the top. There's not a freebie way to just go walk up and it's super cakewalk. It's hard. And most people don't make it. Very few do. And the joy that comes from accomplishing that, even the ones that have gone up, maybe got to halfway up the mountain and storms came and they came down. What an amazing accomplishment. And they're so proud that they even tried. I don't know. It's the things like you've gone through and others have gone through and all of the things that we all go through with sickness and everything. It is through sickness and health. It is part of life that makes it enjoyable and livable and just the most amazing accomplishment ever. When we die and we get to the other side, we're going to look back and go, gosh, you know what? That was incredible. Like that was like a camp you went to that was, and it wasn't easy, but it was worth it. this, if you look back on your life and all the stuff you just went through in the last couple of years, Mark, was it worth it? Is it worth it going through what you just did to define you as a human being?
Yeah. I will say, I don't know if I can answer. Is it worth it? Would I have avoided it if I could have?
Heck yeah.
I might have, yeah. I might have opted out.
Well, for sure.
But there are things that I experienced along the way that have taught me great lessons and have made me a different person in many ways.
For better, do you think?
I think for better, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just one, for example, my sensitivity to the suffering of other people is way high compared to what it used to be. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, heartless before. But boy, I have a depth of understanding. In fact, at one point, funny, at one point during this process, I was so sensitive and attuned to suffering. Like, there were certain TV shows I couldn't even watch because of, you know, violence or mistreatment. I was just like, I can't. I felt it too deeply.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I couldn't even watch them because it affected me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've kind of gotten past that super sensitive phase, but but my empathy, right,
and yeah.
sympathy is just much deeper. And I think that is, you know, the ability to relate with other people in their suffering is, you know, is a good quality. Even,
oh, for sure.
I mean, not to drag this out, but I have a younger brother who's struggled with drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point when I was kind of recovering, trying to come before my first surgery, I was trying to get off of the pain medication. And I was getting off, but I reduced it too quickly. I didn't realize this at first, but I started to have like just terrible aches and all of this sick feeling, and figured out that I was going through withdrawals.
Interesting.
And I thought, oh my gosh. And I just, you know, and I had the medication, I could take it and
yeah.
sort of balance that out and come off it more slowly. But I know my poor brother has been arrested and thrown in jail and had to go, you know, cold turkey off.
Right.
Of,
yeah.
And I just, in fact, I talked to him and I was like, man, that's pretty rough. The withdrawal effects off of opioids is horrible. It's pretty rough.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have a daughter that was opioid addicted, and she said, you know, you take the craving of eating, like when you're really, really hungry and you just want to eat so bad, sit multiply that times 10. When you're addicted, you just want, you crave that drug so bad, you would do anything to get it. And that just is hard for anyone to wrap their head around, you know, unless you've been there, unless you've been an addict, yeah. unless you understand that role. It's tough. It's another brutal thing to endure. And in closing, I just want to ask you, you know, what is the greatest takeaway and final thoughts from your experience? Would you tell the listeners?
Yeah. So my greatest takeaway, having, you know, gone through the spiritual journey and asked a lot of questions and looked in a lot of places, and having been, you know, a believer in God before this started, I reached points though where I felt abandoned completely, like the heavens were completely silent. Like, I would pray. I felt like nothing was going up and nothing was coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I questioned. I was like, okay, well, what now? Like, is God not exist? Is he not there? Is that what I'm learning here? But that's not what I learned. What I learned is there are those moments or times where you don't know, and that might be on purpose. I think it is. Because when you reach that point, like, I feel nothing. Is there no God? Then the question hangs there. What will you do now? And that's what I learned, what it means to have faith. When you don't know and you feel potentially abandoned, that is when you really have to step forward with faith. And I did, and I said, well, I don't know what to make of this. But I believe you're still there. I believe that there's a heavenly Father who's still there watching, and a Savior, Jesus Christ, who is also there. I can't feel him. I can't detect it. But I bet that's my problem and not yours. So I'm just going to hang in there. And then later the moments and the experiences come to tell me that they are there and that they were there. But I had to go through, right? I had to pass through the fire. Because I wouldn't have learned that. I wouldn't know that otherwise. So that test was probably one of my greatest takeaways. And we could talk about lots of takeaways, but...
That's a powerful one. Yeah, that is a powerful one. I love that. And, man, I'm so glad you're alive and... I'm glad you've been able to embrace and learn from the experience that you had. And I think all of us have learned, you know, some things from your story today. And I'm so grateful that you shared it with us, because sharing your story definitely how it lets us learn from it too, Mark. And I'm grateful for you to being on the show and spending time to come here. And I, big things, you know, planned going forward. I mean, is your just, now you're clean and you're back to work and you're riding your Harley and you're playing golf and everything is back as much to normal as possible. Are you afraid? Are you afraid of death approaching? Are you afraid of, you know, anything? Or are you a little bit more familiar with the challenge, you know, that you have in this life?
Thanks. Great questions. I am... You know, interestingly enough, I'm much less afraid. I'm not afraid. Would not be great to die anytime soon.
Yeah. Your wife would really be disappointed. But
mostly because of her, right? I don't want to leave her alone and facing that. And, you know, my children... I'd love to be around to see their lives. Like I mentioned, my first grandchild is just a few months old now, and being able to see her and other things are, you know, lots of reasons I would like to still be around for many years.
For sure.
And, you know, big plans, not huge plans. My life has changed for sure. And I hope to, like, even being here with you today, I hope that, you know, if there's someone out there who listens to this and gains something from it, that will be great for me. And I hope that I can, in whatever aspect, I don't have to go on, you know, huge journeys anywhere. you know, to impact people's lives. But I hope even in my, you know, mundane interactions with people at work or in anything that I do, that I can be an influence for good. Like I can help other people on their journey. And even in the tough parts of the journey.
That's awesome. And like you said earlier, people need people, you know, you need, yeah, that really helps to have that support. And so I would encourage anyone that has a friend that is suffering out there to not forget them, you know, to try and inject yourself into their life and do what you can, because they do appreciate it. And I'm just like you did. So, yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show, and God bless you, man. I wish you the longest life possible going forward and an amazing second half of your journey, and that there's a lot left of it. And so carry on and take care of yourself. Okay. Thanks for being on the show, bud.
Yeah. Happy to. Thanks so much.
You bet.